This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. More people will die, says John Berman on CNN. Thank God somebody's speaking out. This guy who just murdered 49 people in New Zealand says that Donald Trump is, quote, a symbol of renewed white identity and common purpose. He's a Trump fan in New Zealand. And he's not the only Trump fan who's doing this. As, you know, they do this meme, this graphic every day over at Democratic Underground, and the one today is really, Alexander Bissonnette, pro-Trump extremist, shot and killed six at the Islamic Cultural Center in Quebec City, Canada, in January of 2017. Explicitly pro-Trump. Every one of these people explicitly pro-Trump. Nicholas Cruz, pro-Trump extremist, shot and killed 37 people at a high school in Parkland, Florida, in February 2018. Brenton Tarrant, a pro-Trump extremist, shot and killed 49 at a mosque in Christchurch, New Zealand. That would be right now, today. James Alex Fields Jr., pro-Trump extremist, rammed his car into a crowd of anti-Nazi protesters in Virginia, killing one. Cesar Sayoc, a pro-Trump extremist, attempted to kill numerous prominent Democrats by mailing pipe bombs last October. And then yesterday, I believe it was, maybe the day before, Donald Trump says, I have the support of the police, the support of the military, the support of bikers for Trump. I have the tough people. But they don't play it tough until they get to a certain point, and then it would be very, very bad. Well, this guy thought he was being shouted out to, not just by Trump, obviously, but you know, this whole international white supremacy movement. And this is mind-boggling. At the same time that Michael Cohen is saying if Donald Trump loses in 2020, there's not going to be a peaceful transition of power. And Donald Trump is sowing the ground right now by talking about, election fraud and voter fraud all the time. Like, oh, look out. You know, I might actually win, but they'll tell you that I didn't, essentially, is what he's saying, which is how he would justify staying in office. And meanwhile, this new report out from the FBI that right-wing white supremacist terrorists in the United States have killed more people than any other group, including so-called Muslim terrorists. By the way, it's Anything Goes Friday, you know, whatever you want to talk about, but close it? Okay. But I see this as like the biggest issue. I mean, this is just absolutely huge. And I'm kind of at a loss for what do we do about this or what do we do with this? I mean, here we have a white supremacist president, a largely white supremacist Republican political party. I mean, just, you know, look at the photographs of all the Democrats in Congress versus all the Republicans in Congress. There's a theme there. The Democrats actually reflect the variety of America, pretty much to the proportions of the variety of America. But the Republicans, no. It's all white. So, you know, here we have this extraordinary situation where we have people who actually think that killing other people is the way to accomplish something. They've coalesced around a political ideology. They are cranked up and ginned up and freaked out and filled with fear every single day by right-wing hate radio and Fox so-called news, you know, billionaire oligarch media. Our media is really downplaying the fact that this guy in his manifesto shouted out to Donald Trump and talked about it's all about white supremacy. They're saying he's anti-Muslim. He was specifically anti-immigrant. And it wasn't so much the religion as it was the race of these people that caused him to want to kill them. Although the religion was another part of it. I mean, you know, this whole Christian identity, white national thing, they tend to kind of come together right there at the, you know, at the Pat Robertson junction. And the FBI is telling us, you know, we've got a serious problem. And therefore, you know, we've got a serious problem. What are we going to do about this? Here we have Josh Campbell over at CNN. This is from today. The headline, FBI seen uptick in domestic terror arrests. There was an uptick in U.S. domestic terror arrests, according to a senior FBI official who says that with nearly 25 arrests in the first quarter of this year, 2019 is going to be the highest arrest tempo quarters, in other words, the arrest tempo, the speed of the most arrests in the last few years related to domestic terrorism. The FBI has approximately 900 open domestic terror investigations going on right now. And then they note, you know, Christopher Paul Hassan, a Coast Guard lieutenant arrested last month on firearms and narcotics charges stemming from an FBI investigation that unearthed his plans for a widespread attack on prominent elected officials and several, you know, liberal television anchors. I mean, I got another threat in the mail yesterday, in the email yesterday. It's like this stuff is coming constantly. Robert Gregory Bowers, the guy who shot people at the Tree of Life Synagogue. Cesar Sayoc. Again, these guys are people who openly say that they support Donald Trump in addition to the whole white supremacist thing. These four guys in Southern California were arrested in October with, you know, traveling to political rallies across California where they violently attacked counter-protesters, journalists, and in one case, a cop, which is what took them down. And one of these guys had been at the Unite the Right rally in Virginia where he had been charged with a crime. Joseph Digby, one of two remaining FBI fugitives and domestic terrorism suspects, linked to the FBI's long-running Operation Backfire, who was apprehended in Cuba this past summer and returned to the U.S. I mean, these are just examples of this. Donald Trump and his very fine people. Other stuff going on, by the way. Today is the day that all across the country, in the very best of schools, now this would be a way of determining whether your school is under or overperforming, the kids are walking out in protest of the lack of attention to climate change in the United States. And you know, God bless them. It's a good thing. So anyhow, we will pick up your phone calls in just a minute here. It's 14 and a half minutes past the hour. I think I've said what I have to say. We need to be pushing back on this. We need to be pushing back in the media. We need to be calling out the president. We need to be calling out the Republican Party for their tacit support or their failure to speak out against this white supremacist violence. We need to remember our history. We all need to be speaking out. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with your calls right after this. Stick around. And welcome back. Michael in Imperial Beach, California, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Okay, Anything Goes Friday, and
you bet.
This is ugly. Now, PBS had a great series on last weekend about slavery in America.
Mm-hmm. And you mean modern-day slavery or historic slavery?
It started from the 1500s, and it brought it up to modern day. So
okay.
It did the whole thing.
Right.
And I understand slavery was a business, but I'm trying to get the mindset of those early American white people who had power pertaining to slavery versus the Native Americans. The mindset with slavery was you spend money, you pay people to go ship them over to Africa, to to kidnap people, bring them back, turn them into slaves, which required food, shipping costs, clothing, shelter. With the Native Americans, these evil white men, their mindset was kill every last one of them. So my question to you, Tom, is why did the early whites pay people to kidnap Africans when they had millions of Native Americans they could have turned into slaves without paying the cost of shipping and all that stuff? And if you knew what percentage of Native Americans were captured and actually turned into slaves?
It was a relatively small percentage. And what it speaks to, Michael, is the just fact of human nature and psychology that if you are going to enslave a population, one of the very first things you have to do is cut them off from any hope, cut them off from any lifeline, cut them off from any connection to their original culture, their ancestors, their lands, cut them off from their religion, cut them off from their language. If you can accomplish that, and there were efforts to do that among Native Americans. In fact, the whole Indian school thing was, you know, one of the gentler of those efforts, taking Native American children away from their parents. They were doing this with Aboriginal folks, people in Australia right up until the 1970s. We were doing this in the United States to Native Americans up until the 1950s, taking, you know, Native American children away from their families, putting them in boarding schools, teaching them English, forbidding them from practicing their religion, causing them to forget their history, their traditions, and then adopting them out to white families. It was a very common practice in the United States. But that was just to destroy the Indian tribes. But the reason why Native Americans didn't make good slaves, or they couldn't accomplish slavery, let's say, let's put it on the side of the white guys who were doing this. The reason it was much harder for these slave owners and slave masters to turn Native Americans into slaves than it was for people who had been dragged from another continent was because the Native Americans, if they escaped, they had a place to escape to. Yeah, they if they could have any contact at all with their people, they could keep their religion and their language intact. And that was not the case with Africans who were brought here and then isolated on plantations generation after generation. And their connection to their language, their connection to their religion, their connection to even their identity, the name of their original tribes, were all shattered, all broken. That was the first requirement of slavery. And that's, in my opinion, Michael, and having read a fair amount of sociology around the subject over the years, that's why that difference exists. Make sense?
Yeah, it does, and I think this does tie into what happened in New Zealand. You know, I think that it's Trump is bringing it out again.
Well, and New Zealand has the same history of genocide of Native people that we do here in the United States. So, you know, it shouldn't surprise us that there is, you know, genocidal violence going on in New Zealand. Michael, thank you for the call. And of course, it was the white people who did it, and it's a white guy in New Zealand who's shooting the temper. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, at the bottom of the hour, very quickly, Julia Olson, who's the executive director of Our Children's Trust, who's doing this lawsuit that actually might force the U.S. government to stop subsidizing the fossil fuel industry. She's going to be on the program briefly because today's the day that kids all across the nation are walking out of school, and a fine thing it is. So there we go. Mark in Valley, Washington. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I mean, let me preface my discussion by saying I'm all for extended background checks on weapons, and I'm all for letting that gun wait until the background check is complete before you can get it.
Yep.
But as the conversation we had about a year ago when you said I was calling people to arms, this is what I was afraid of, that Trump was going to get squirrely. He was going to start calling out to the neo-Nazis, the KK, the ultra-right, and that when they come after us, they're going to have semi-automatic, if not automatic, weapons, and you better be ready to defend yourself. I live in a rural county where I can't rely on the police getting here to defend me, so you have to be ready to defend yourself. And unfortunately, in the world we live in, when everything melts down, these people are going to be heavily armed, and they're not going to be worried about shooting people.
You know, and we saw elements of this, you know, after Hurricane Katrina, for example. I can't you know, Mark, if your call, if what you're saying is that, you know, liberals need to be arming themselves because conservatives are coming after us with guns, which essentially is what Donald Trump said day before yesterday or yesterday, you know, or at least that's how I interpret what he had to say. I just can't go there, Mark. I mean, that's like saying, you know, we're going to have a civil war. We're going to have a shooting war. We're going to be killing each other. It's going to be brother against brother. And, you know, or American against American at the very least. And I really think that instead what we need to be doing, instead of putting our energy, and Mark, thank you for the call on it, instead of putting our energy into buying guns, I think we need to put our energy into banning guns. We need to put our energy into doing what Australia did, New Zealand did not do, and making it much more difficult to get these high-powered semi-automatic weapons of war, basically. Nicholas in San Cristobal, Mexico. Hey, Nicholas. Thanks for watching us on YouTube and moderating our chat room there. What's up?
Thank you. Some days are easier than others. I'm actually calling you from Lexington, Kentucky, believe it or not, where I'm sort of hostage for the month.
Cool.
But so far I haven't run into Mitch yet, so that's good.
Yeah.
In general, the news is beyond horrifying, of course. And possibly interestingly, right before I came on to Mod, a friend had sent me an old video clip of Kurt Vonnegut, believe it or not, from 1991, point being 28 years ago. And he was talking about exactly this and how all the mainstream media, including PBS, NPR, he included all of them from 28 years ago, saying how they'd all fallen in line with the nationalistic jingo of basically white supremacy, power, the power structure. And it led me to think, if that was Kurt Vonnegut of all people from 28 years ago, how in the world are we going to correct this? Whatever it's requiring is going to require an enormous amount of time and energy. And I think what we need to do is encourage the people who have the money to do as many public service announcements on every channel possible, including Fox, force them somehow.
Public service announcements to say what?
What?
Public service announcements to say what?
Well, explaining, you know, as with as great clarity as possible, that we are all one human family. Hmm. And if we are not, then what are we?
Yeah. Then what we are is we are people at war with ourselves. We're at war with life itself, actually.
Exactly. And no society can withstand that for very long.
Yeah, agreed. Nicholas, agreed. Very, very well said. Thank you. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Well, hello, everybody. Good morning. And please don't be alarmed. But me and the kids, we've got a coup going on in the country now. If you notice, most of the kids that walked out of school, we've got some lieutenants. We're going to put Mr. Governor Easley, is that his name, in charge of our global warming program. He's got subpoena powers. He's going to subpoena the Koch brothers, and he's got we're going to nationalize the petroleum industry also. We're going to put Amy Klobuchar in charge of attacking the pharmaceutical industry. We're 5% of the world population, but we're 80% of the use of opiates, okay? So we're going to put her in charge of that. We're going to have Ilhan Omar in charge of our foreign policy. Ocasio-Cortez is going to be in charge of our domestic policy. Elizabeth Warren is going to be in charge of attacking Wall Street and the banking. We're going to have free college education in this country like they do in Germany. You can't have more than $100 million in cash or assets. And we're going to decriminalize the drug use in this country. We're going to have Robert Francis O'Rourke is going to be the press secretary. Louis Farrakhan is going to be in charge of the New American Church. And we're going to put Bernie Sanders in charge of our universal health care programs in this country. All news media reporting will be non-commercialized. We're going to replace the Star Spangled Banner with a moment of silence, followed by a loud scream of excitement. Okay? And that's pretty much, we're not going to destroy capitalism, but we're going to tax the hell out of it. So don't be alarmed. Going to work and everything should be okay, all right?
Okay, Morris. What's so amazing is I think pretty much everything that you said that was policy actually exists in other countries that are doing just fine, thank you very much. And it's interesting that, you know, Morris was back-to-back. Morris has hung up. Morris was back-to-back with Nicholas, you know, who normally lives in Mexico and is, you know, helps run our YouTube chat room. And Nicholas told us the story a few weeks ago about the way that AMLO, the Bernie Sanders of Mexico, who is now the president of Mexico, how AMLO became president. And the main little trick that he did toward the end of the campaign was he announced who his cabinet would be. Now, you know, just like they say a budget is a statement of moral values, so is a cabinet. If Trump had campaigns saying, I'm going to put in my cabinet a billionaire woman who doesn't, you know, who hates public schools and a billionaire bankster who hides money and Rick Perry, I'm going to put him, you know, this idiot, I'm going to put him in charge of the nuclear bombs. And I mean, you know, people would have just been horrified. Right? And I think that, you know, once we've got a Democratic ticket, an actual candidate for president and vice president, I think, frankly, they need to announce what their cabinet's going to be. I think Nicholas's idea, or actually AMLO's idea, you know, down there in Mexico, the current president of Mexico, it's a brilliant idea. And Morris was just laying that out. So great minds think alike, Morris and Nicholas. Thanks, guys. We'll be back with more of your calls after this. It's Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
It's the home of the political revolution, speaking the truths that multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. On the line with us is Julia Olson, the Executive Director and Chief Legal Counsel for Our Children's Trust, also an adjunct professor at the University of Oregon School of Law. OurChildrensTrust.org is the website. The Twitter handle is YouthVGov, Y-O-U-T-H, V as in versus Gov, G-O-V. Julia, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So today we've got kids all across the nation walking out. Is this something that you all were involved with, or is just an organic process? I mean, how did this come about?
So the youth U.S. climate strike that's happening today was really inspired by Greta Thunberg, who is a climate activist in Sweden. She's 16, and she has been striking every Friday for quite a long time now, and she called on the youth of the world to join her on March 15th and do a school strike. Mm. And so three young girls in the U.S., two are in middle school and one is in high school, they took up the mantle to organize, and this is their youth-led effort, and we are supporting them, but this is their work.
That's great. That's great. So tell us, where is the recap the lawsuit for us, and then tell us where you're at on that right now, please.
Sure. So I assume you're talking about the Juliana versus U.S. lawsuit first?
That's correct.
Should we start with that one?
Yeah.
Okay. So the Juliana case is right now pending in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And you might recall last fall we were about 10 days out from starting our trial, and the Supreme Court temporarily stayed that. And they ultimately let us move forward, but then the Ninth Circuit and the District Court decided that there should be an early review of some of the legal questions in the case. So we have fully briefed that appeal that's happening right now, and we will have oral argument in Portland, Oregon in June, likely the first week of June.
That's great. I'm very, very much looking forward to that. Are there other lawsuits? You said, was I asking specifically about this one? Or are you guys involved in other lawsuits as well?
We are. We support youth climate lawsuits against state governments here in the U.S., and we also support youth abroad who are suing their governments.
That's great.
And, right in Oregon, there's an important case that's going up to the Oregon Supreme Court right now. It is actually being supported by Multnomah County on the side of the youth.
That's great. And what are we calling for here? We're talking with Julie Olson, the executive director of OurChildrensTrust.org. Is it just to ask the federal government, and in the case of presumably state lawsuits, the state governments to stop subsidizing fossil fuels, or to start subsidizing green energy? Or, I mean, how far are we going with these appeals?
Yeah, what the youth are seeking in each of these cases is first for the courts to engage on this existential threat, a threat that is really harming these young people's lives and their personal security and the fundamental rights that we all have. and to declare that the governments are infringing on those fundamental constitutional rights and destroying public trust resources like air and water, mm-hmm. and then to order governments to not only stop the harmful practices like subsidies and continuing to promote fossil fuel energy, but to develop plans that would be based on what the scientists say is necessary to decarbonize our energy systems quickly enough to try to halt climate change.
Extraordinary. Extraordinary. Julia, you're doing great work, and thanks so much for dropping by the program today and updating us on what's going on.
Thanks, Tom. Always great to be here.
And by the way, Julia, before you go, I'm assuming that the best way people can learn more about this is by going to ourchildrenstrust.org.
That's right. And then youthvgov.org is our public engagement platform, too. So check us out in both places.
Okay, great. Youthvgov.org. And youthvgov is the Twitter handle. Thank you so much, Julia.
Yep.
Great speaking.
Thanks, Tom.
Appreciate it. Back to Anything Goes Friday here. Tamara in Carl Junction, Missouri. Hey, Tamara, thanks for listening. What's on your mind today? Oh, Tamara is listening to her TV, apparently, instead of her telephone. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? I hope you're sitting down for this one, Tom.
Okay.
I want to talk about 5G.
All right.
Okay, Tom. 237 scientists in 43 different countries are begging the world to stop this 5G rollout. Here are some of the symptoms, Tom. Increased cancer risk, cellular stress on your cells, increased harmful free radicals, which causes cancer, genetic damage, reproductive system damage, learning memory damage, development disorders, Alzheimer's. It hurts plants and animals also, Tom. Lack of energy for humans, flu-like symptoms, infertility, concentration problems, sleep difficulty, depression.
Yeah, no, I get it. I've seen the list, Wayne, and I've seen that list associated with prior iterations of cell phones. And I've seen the research, particularly out of Finland, suggesting that yes, there is a correlation between cell phone use and in particular, specifically brain cancer. And I think that's personally, I just think that's what got Ted Kennedy. And I think that's probably what got Joe's son as well, you know, the vice president's son. But 5G, you know, my hope for 5G is that it's a much higher frequency. And when these frequencies start getting into this real, real high range, this millimeter wave frequency band, they are less effective at penetrating than are the frequencies that we're using right now. I mean, there's a group of parents who are suing right now because they think that a cell tower on top of the school caused several of their kids to develop cancer. Again, you know, this is very controversial stuff. But what I have learned about 5G, and I believe this to be true, Wayne, and I may be wrong on this, and we're stepping into this giant experiment here, a giant epidemiological experiment, is that the reason why you need so many more cell towers for 5G, and there's going to be 10 to 100 times more cell towers for 5G than there were for 4G and LTE. The reason why you need so many more cell towers is that the radiation doesn't penetrate as far. It doesn't go as far, and it doesn't penetrate the skin. It's why they use that same kind of radiation for the millimeter wave scanners in the airports, because it won't penetrate the skin. And so it represents much less of a risk of that long list of things that you just read, Wayne. So, you know, that's what I've read in some of the technical journals. But I don't know. I'm skeptical of any new technology, and particularly, you know, constantly being bathed in high levels of radiation. So we'll see where it goes.
You finished, Tom, okay? Well, listen to this.
Yeah.
The Vienna International Center in Vienna, Austria, it's a UN building. they are begging the UN Secretary General in that building to stop with the Wi-Fi and the mobile phone boosters. Everybody in the building is getting sick, Tom, right now.
Yeah, but, you know, one sick building doesn't necessarily mean that it's electromagnetic radiation that's causing it, Wayne. Sick buildings are more often tied to things like mold or, lack of ventilation.
Leaking
heating systems.
The lady laid it out for the Secretary General exactly what's happening. As soon as they put those Wi-Fi and motor phone boosters inside the building, low ceilings, metal ceilings and all that type of stuff, that's when people started getting sick.
Yeah.
You got to get on it, Tom. It's going to be a disaster of biblical proportions, I promise you.
Okay. We'll see, Wayne. We will see. I mean, this, like I said, this is going to be a giant epidemiological experiment, just like all the previous rollouts of cell phones are, and the issues and the studies are still a matter of debate, frankly. Wayne, thank you for the call. John in Jeffersonville, Ohio. John, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I wanted to basically put my opinion out on whether or not we need to impeach President Trump or not.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, if you go with Nancy Pelosi's fundamental thought is that if we can't convict, then why bother, okay? And so I'd like to just give you a little...
I don't think that's what she's saying, John. I think it's more subtle than that. I think she's saying if the majority of the American people don't support us, then why bother?
Can I lay out my scenario real quickly, though? Okay, if you have down in Texas, you have a black woman that gets raped by a white man in a white neighborhood. Okay, and the only witness is a black man with a checkered past. The prosecutor could say, well, you know, I mean, this is a white area. We're in Texas. I probably won't, prosecute. So why bother? Okay, that's kind of where I'm. That's one point. The second point is the Trump only cares about one thing, and that's money. His money is based on his brand. He's got his name on everything. Trump this, Trump that, whatever.
Right.
Can you imagine what damage that would do to his ego? If President Obama served two terms and one of the greatest presidents, and then we had Trump and he was impeached.
Yeah.
So
the thing is, John, you know what?
From office, he's at least impeached, and that's on his record.
Yeah, I get that, and you're assuming that Trump and Trump supporters, if he's impeached in the House but not convicted in the Senate, will consider that a key, an element of great shame, which is how tragically Al Gore viewed Bill Clinton's being impeached, and that's why in the 2000 election, Al Gore wouldn't let one of the most popular politicians in the nation at the time, Bill Clinton, campaigned for him, which was a huge mistake. But the fact of the matter is that Donald Trump has no shame, and most of his followers have no shame, and they don't care. I mean, they don't. You know, he's got over 20 women who have accused him of sexual assault. He bragged about it on videotape. They're willing to, the evangelicals are willing to cut him a pass for that. He bragged about going into the Teenage Miss USA and ogling, teenage girls who are naked and, how he got off on that. I mean, this guy is sick and twisted and they're just fine with it. And so if he gets impeached in the House, which is really just an indictment, and then is not convicted in the Senate, he's going and his supporters are going to take that as a victory. Bill Clinton did not do a victory lap when the Senate failed to convict him. Donald Trump will, just like they're taking these two Manafort convictions where the judges in both cases said, this case had nothing to do with whether the Russians were messing with the U.S. election. These cases had to do with Paul Manafort being a serial criminal long before that. That's what we just litigated. And both Manafort's lawyers and Trump said, see, the judge said there's no collusion, which the judges never said. So if he's going to lie about, and Donald Trump lied about it several times just in the last couple of days, if Trump is going to lie about the outcome of the Manafort hearings to make himself look good, if he wins in the Senate, or if we fail to convict in the Senate, he's going to take that as a victory, and it's going to add to his power. It's going to be bragging rights for him. It's going to give his boosters another jolt of testosterone. And they're going to figure, hey, things are, life is getting better day by day. I'm very concerned about that, John, and I agree with Nancy Pelosi. You should not impeach this man unless there's a high probability that he will be convicted. You do not go after somebody like Trump if you cannot take them down. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls and the news of the day right after this. And welcome back, Leonard in South Pasadena, California. Hey, Leonard, thanks for watching on Free Speech. What's on your mind today?
Oh, how you doing, Tom? It's good to hear from you.
Thank you. I'm talking
about socialism.
Yeah.
Socialism is for people. Pay a little bit of money, get a big service.
Yeah, that's why it's called socialism.
Yeah, social, for people.
Right.
Socialism is for people.
Society.
If you don't like socialism, you don't like people.
Yep.
And apparently the billionaires or the greedy people have proven this by having 80 to 90,000 people die annually for profits. Gun accidents, car accidents.
The number's much bigger than
drugs,
that.
Yeah, et cetera, et cetera. It's unbelievable the amount of money these guys make on people's lives and deaths. This is like we're having people die just for money. And, you know, I think people should realize that this is not what we really want. And socialism is what we really want. Not everything social. Just the needs of the people should be handled by socialists, and let the capitalists have the rest.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you. It's a great rant. So, how do you convert that into a way? Are you suggesting basically that the bumper sticker, the slogan, should be socialism is for people,
right?
And capitalism is for corporations, or capitalism is for billionaires, or?
Right. It's designed for the few. It always has been. People say capitalism's broke them. No, it's not. It's doing exactly what it's supposed to do.
Yeah. Amen. Leonard, thank you for the call. Sharon in Garland, Texas. Hey, Sharon. Thanks for watching this on YouTube. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Thanks so much for taking the call.
Sure. What's up, Sharon?
I am calling today. So according to the Southern Poverty Law Center,
mm-hmm.
hate groups are up at a 20-year high.
Yes.
That is no coincidence with who we have in office. Now, I'm not saying Trump is a white supremacist, but he sure knows how to rally them.
Well,
I
will say he is.
I
think there's plenty of evidence that he is.
Oh, I agree as well. But you know how triggered people get. You know when Trump supporters get when you call them.
I really don't care
if
they get triggered.
So, but what I wanted to do today, Tom, is call and make sure that everyone here listening watches the Frontline PBS ProPublica documentary series called "Documenting Hate." We all know that hate groups that are out there, white supremacists, surely exist in this country.
Mm.
But what they're actively doing now that I think is a little different, and maybe you can tell me otherwise if you know so, is that they're actively recruiting troops, military members. Now, these kids are coming home. They've been used to having camaraderie while they're in with their, active duty. And then they're coming home with impressionable minds. You know, they already have fear and anger stoked
right.
within
and they're,
them.
And they basically lost their tribe, and these white nationalists are coming to them saying, we're your new
exactly.
tribe.
Exactly. Bingo. Yeah. Yes, yeah. sir. And so I wanted to make sure everyone watches that. And
so
knows,
is that something, Sharon,
on.
Where you have to look at your pardon my interrupting you, but we only have 30 seconds left. Is this the kind of thing where you look on your TV listings and see when it's playing on PBS, or is it online?
It's actually on YouTube and on PBS.
Okay.
It is. So everybody watch it, know what we're dealing with, so we can all come back and combat it. Once Trump is thrown out of office, we can vote out his corrupt co-conspirators, and we can banish those of his supporters who are truly deplorable back under their hoods and out of our political landscape.
So the documentary is called Documenting Hate. Is that the title?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great.
Documenting Hate.
Sharon,
yes,
I was
watch it and share it liberally.
Yeah,
thank you,
I was only peripherally aware of that. So thank you for that, Sharon. Thank you very much, and thanks for watching us on YouTube. We'll be right back. It's coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Coming up on 8 minutes before the hour. I'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 52 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday. Arnold, I don't have a city for you, Arnold, but I see, a 404 area code? You're probably calling from Georgia?
Correct.
Okay, so what's on your mind?
You asked what should we be doing about Trump and the system we're involved with right now.
Right.
we should explain from the beginning, from 1492, the meaning of the Monroe Doctrine, which explains where we are today. And it's surprising to me that Bolton and Abram would even bring that up, knowing what it actually means.
Well, the Monroe Doctrine, hang on just a second. The Monroe Doctrine was, I mean, I would not disagree that it was an aspect of white nationalism, because that's what America was founded on. You know, it's, I mean, that was, and Monroe, James Monroe was a slaveholder and all that kind of stuff. But basically what the Monroe Doctrine says is that anything that happens anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, Central and South America, is within the sphere of interest of the United States, and therefore we have a legitimate right to intervene in those events, essentially. That was the Monroe Doctrine.
Correct. Correct. I agree. As the master.
Yeah. Yeah. As we were the only, European version of a modern nation state that was, you know, fairly well advanced by the time that James Monroe was president. That was what, the 1830s, as I recall, or the late 1820s.
Right.
So.
And then, see, now when you go to the class system, the European class system, such as the king, queen, earl, duke, baron.
Yep.
And everybody else was slaves in Europe. They were nothing. Serfs, they were treated as slaves.
Yep.
Although
the serfs, let's be clear here, Arnold. The life of a serf in medieval Europe was a paradise compared to the life of a slave in colonial America.
Well, I agree. But when they sent those,
so I think calling serfs slaves is a disservice to slave to people who are descendants of slavery and to the memory of people who experienced slavery. Just like calling a minor massacre a Holocaust is a disservice to the Holocaust that happened to 100 million Native Americans here on North America and 5 million Jews or 6 million Jews in Germany and others.
I was trying to bring it to the point that where they ended up in America as far as being the first slaves.
Right. Right.
When they sent the bottom class here, the bottom class whites were those who was considered worthless. Not slaves, but they was not noticed, what I'm saying.
Okay.
So when they sent those people here, they sent them here as indentured servants.
Right. Although the indentures were time limited.
True. But then the third example I would say, but somebody needs to explain the meaning of white privilege. This is where racism really came from. So somebody needs to explain this so that the white people can understand, just how blind they are to where they are and why they are where they are with the position that they have as white privilege.
Yeah. Well, I would, in shorthand, super shorthand, say white privilege is that white people basically set this country up just for white people and exploited and stole and robbed and raped and pillaged people of color throughout that process. And the modern incarnation of that is that, whites have inured benefit for that through all these generations. And one of the biggest benefits of white privilege for white people is that they don't have to even think about white privilege, that white people walk through a world that's very different than that that people of color do in the United States, and frankly, in most other countries that are major white dominated.
Right, but
am I missing something here?
Well, the part that I was centering on was the Beacon Rebellion defines that because he didn't have an army. Just like George Washington didn't have an army. So you have to use somebody to go up and fight and die for your interest. And capitalism needs someone to do whatever they need someone to do, because the cheap labor is what the whole system is built on.
Oh, sure.
So when the slaves rebel, that put a scare into the system because they had no protection.
Yeah, I think you could argue, Arnold, that capitalism is a more elegant and somewhat more humane way of extending the benefits of serfdom, essentially, and frankly the economic benefits of slavery to the overclass, as it were. We'll talk about it after the break.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.